Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Isn't it bliss? And isn't it queer? I'm losing my timing this late in my career. So send in the clowns. You know, there ought to be clowns. Don't bother, they're here.
Ireland's Got Talent, or does it? That's not the whole title of the show. It's just called Ireland's Got Talent. It's on Saturdays at 7:30 on TV3. Of course, you can catch up on the TV3 player. James Dempsey joins us once again. This is a new outing for yet another British format.
Yeah, although not just British. I mean, I think I was looking into it. The Got Talent sort of flat pack TV production has been sold to roughly 60 countries around the world. So it is fairly well packaged at this stage. And I was quite pleased to see that in France, it's called France Has Incredible Talent and is presented by David Ginola. The former footballer.
Look at my hair.
So look, I mean, what can I say about this? Because everyone knows already what it is. I think what's more interesting about Ireland's Got Talent is how well I think they pulled off the first episode, in the sense that I think it held its own with the UK one, in as much as I've seen the UK one, which is only really in passing anyway. What I thought worked really, really well was I thought the judges gelled quite well together, and I'll go through them in a moment.
I just had to look one of them up because I'd never heard of her.
I think that's probably the case for lots of people. The variety of talent also was kind of the usual strange.
Well, isn't that the whole idea that it's singing dogs and stuff?
Basically, What I think is kind of interesting about this versus the UK one is, in the UK one, you win presumably some jackpot of money that I'm not quite sure. And I think the point is you get a slot on the Royal Variety Performance. Now, we don't have a Royal Variety Performance.
Okay.
We don't have any, Republic Variety Performance. Unless you count the toy show, which is kind of the only shot of variety in the country. So TV3 are giving the winner of this 50 grand, which, you know, happily anyone would take, as well as seemingly an hour-long show about that person, which is sort of more than I thought many of the talents that got through would be able to sustain. Because, I mean, you know, just to go through some of them, right, we heard in that clip there Evelyn Williams, who was this 81-year-old great granny who was definitely the darling on social, you know, the Susan Boyle, we'll say, of episode one. Then you had mini puppet pop stars, which were these, a father and his two kind of teenage or young adult children, sort of running around in sort of miniature, I don't know how you would describe it, like a sleeping bag with a tiny Michael Jackson sewn onto the front. And and I don't know if you could get an hours long worth, you know, program out of that particular talent. So I'm interested to see where it'll go. Now, as for the judges themselves, right? So you have Louis Walsh, Jason Byrne, Denise Van Outen, and the one I presume you were unfamiliar with, Michelle Visage. Now, I am not unfamiliar with her because she is RuPaul's best friend and a longtime judge on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Okay, all right.
So I am familiar with her very overly glamorous style. And when I was sitting down with my flatmate to watch Ireland's Got Talent, she was like, "Who's she?" And I said, "Oh, she's a judge on this like drag show reality contest." And she replied, "Is she a drag queen?" And I said, "No, she's not. But she, she."
I can see why they might have made that mistake. Perhaps, you know, a bit less makeup.
What she is, I think, is actually a better judge than, to be honest, Louis. Louis, I think, is the weakest link of the judges. I find Louis Walsh's kind of shtick really tiresome at this point. And I actually kind of had to laugh that at the beginning of the show, you had Louis come out and say something like, "You know, what I'm looking for is something new." And I was kind of looking at Louis going, "Yeah, so am I, Louis. And I've seen you've been doing this for like how many years? 2 decades at least worth of this, you know." And Louis's comments are always just, "Oh, Sean, you come on the stage. You're from Galway. You're really nice. You've got talent."
Yeah.
You've got
That's
it.
That's okay. Who's the baddie then out of them?
Now, so far, none of them has emerged as the real, you know, stone cold baddie. Mm. They all seem quite metered and fair and actually nice. And I don't mean that in a kind of faint praise damning way. They're actually, I thought they gelled actually very well as a foursome. So you also have, Jason Byrne, a stand-up comedian, adds the jokes, right? Yeah. He does that quite well. Denise Van Outen, I think, actually is quite warm and friendly, but also, like, you know, she, to give an example, she potentially could have been the meanest one, because at one point she championed this guy who was playing the spoons. He was rubbish. And then she was like, no, right? It was a bit lacking in that kind of look at this fool they brought out on the stage to, you know, to tear apart and crucify. I don't know if that's a bad thing, because when you see that on presumably you do see that from time to time on Britain's Got Talent, no one is unwise to the fact that there is an audition process to this,
yeah.
That nobody has made it to the stage without going through several gatekeepers,
yeah.
And that those served up as sacrificial lambs are done so just for, you know, a bit of TV delectation. Now, there was one woman who they kind of offered for that. Well, maybe two. The Samba women weren't great either. But there was this singer who just did a variety of songs that sort of all ran into each other. She was, you know, grand. Like, she was fine, but nothing special. And they pretty much told her that as well. There was no, you know, vicious kind of stick the knife in moment.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a bad thing if in 2018 we've moved beyond that kind of particular trope into something else. But if that's what people wanted, they weren't going to get it.
I thought Ireland's Got Talent, or the Got Talent franchise was about the weird acts.
Yes.
The things you don't expect people to do.
I guess, that's where you got the mini pop star people.
For instance.
Yes,
yeah.
But as I said, I don't know how much lasting power there is in the really weird ones. Because if you look back at who the people who are successful in this show, you've got, you know, Susan Boyle and Paul Potts, who are singers, essentially, and Diversity, which is a dance group, you know.
Yeah.
Have any of the really weird... some dog one, but then it was very controversial because it turned out there were multiple dogs. But anyway. but I hope that's right, that I have a defamed
Daddy. Yeah.
Anyway.
Let's distance ourselves from James Dempsey's comments about whatever that dog was.
Yeah.
What does James Kavanagh and Glenda Gilson, what do they do on the show?
So they present Ireland's Got More Talent, which is M-O for the Or, which I think is some solid wordplay in the TV3 production department there. That is the kind of companion show that would traditionally be on ITV2,
yeah.
But is actually on TV3, because if they're going to spend money on it, well, God, yeah, they're going to put it on the main channel. So it means you get between, I don't know if it's an hour and a half or 2 hours to 3 hours of Ireland's Got Talent in a row, which is a lot.
That's a big commitment.
It is a big commitment. You have to compare it to Dancing with the Stars Ireland, which is on Sunday night, right? I think so. And
That's a long show too.
That is a long show too. And at least this has more variety and more sort of immediate familiarity, because while there are judges in Ireland's Got Talent, essentially they have as much sort of cultural awareness of talent as any of the viewers do, you know, in the sense of determining whether a talent obscure is good or not.
But they know about dancing.
Well, they know about dancing, yeah. Okay, I'll give you that. But I, as a casual viewer, know more about in Ireland's Got Talent, it opened with this guy who did Vogue dancing, which appealed very much to Michelle Visage, because she sort of had come up in that scene in New York. And, any casual viewer would have been able to recognise that this voguing man, I think his name was Zach, was a very good voguer, we'll say.
Okay.
But I can't necessarily watch a Paso Doble and say, I know exactly if you did the right step, if you were on the right, you know, if you're... Whatever, I can't even waffle off now stuff, because I don't have the right vocabulary to do it. So I think there's sort of a greater distance in Dancing with the Stars, even though that has been on TV for well over a decade as well. People can say Paso Doble without knowing what it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. When in that, you hope they're going to fall over. Or
yeah, exactly.
Like that. That's so, the gist of it.
Now, Dancing with the Stars won in the ratings battle, but just by 50,000 viewers.
Really?
So Ireland's Got Talent pulled in just under 500,000, which I think for TV3 is a good return on investment, because obviously
that was actually a good day, because that was the same day as the rugby. They got a million for the rugby.
Definitely. So I talked a couple of weeks ago in the TV news about what had been the top 20 most viewed moments, and TV3 hadn't entered any of them in 2017. you can guarantee that they already have at least one spot from last Saturday.
One last thing, though. They have these four judges, Louis Walsh, Jason Byrne. You know, one could argue as to whether, you know, you like them or not, yeah. But they're both Irish. Why do we need a Denise Van Outen and RuPaul's friend? Can we not find Irish people to do this work themselves?
I mean, I don't know. I guess they want to bring some kind of name in, right? Mm. Is the point. They presumably want a gender balance on the panel of four, is what I would imagine. Who would you go for? Who would you put in that judging spot in their place?
I don't know, but you probably could get... Well, off the top of my head, I don't know, but no doubt you could.
Undoubtedly, you could get these people.
You could get a couple of women who'd sit in there and know what voguing was definitely. And be able to say that was rubbish.
Definitely, but I think if you look at, certainly the America's Got Talent, the judges on that are like Heidi Klum, Mel B of the Spice Girls. There's always an international... And even the contestants are somewhat international. They come from different countries to appear in it, even though it's called whatever country's got talent. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, moving on to some TV news. Now, don't be surprised if you see Michelle Visage appearing in a Star Wars-connected TV show, because it seems everyone's getting involved now.
Very much so.
Game of Thrones people.
They are actually been given the keys to the, you know, galaxy far, far away to create their own trilogy of movies. But Disney has announced, so Bob Iger is the head of Disney. He has announced that they are working on multiple TV shows which will come out in 2019. Now, this is because Disney is planning to launch its own direct-to-consumer app, which is basically a Netflix and, well, basically Netflix alternative and Amazon alternative, but mostly Netflix alternative, because they've removed already all of their Disney content from Netflix. You can't get it anymore.
Ah, right.
So they are going to launch late in 2019 with their own, you know, Disneyflix, whatever we're going to call it. And on it is going to be multiple Star Wars TV shows. Now, we don't know what format they're going to take, whether they are live action or animated, because there have been animated and currently are animated Star Wars things, which I think if you're a true Star Wars, you know, canonical fanatic, you'd probably already watch. What else is coming that I don't know will tip people into paying to subscribe to this or not is there'll also be a Monsters, Inc. TV show, which is a fondly regarded Pixar movie. Less intrigued by the High School Musical spin-off TV series that no one is asking for, at least, you know, 10 years after that trilogy came undone. All we know about it so far is that multiple TV shows are in development, and they couldn't say yet who is going to be making them, but that the talent described was described as, you know, quote, significant, end quote.
Ka-ching.
Yeah.
And while Netflix never reveal, of course, the absolute figures for, you know, how many people watch their shows, they have, is it a list of most binged watch shows by country?
It was somewhat cumbersome in their explanation, right? But basically, between its launch in October 2012 and December 2017, Netflix examined the streaming data, whatever, I'm not quite sure what we say on this side of the pond, and said that the first program that people binge, they sort of revealed the most popular program that people made their first Netflix binge on in Ireland. They broke it down by country. And in Ireland, the most popular show was Breaking Bad, followed by Orange is the New Black, then House of Cards, Narcos, Stranger Things, Peaky Blinders, Making a Murderer, Gossip Girl, Prison Break, and Sons of Anarchy round off the top 10.
Yeah, great surprise there.
What I thought was interesting was how exactly they defined the things, right? So they defined a binge as being completing any one season of a TV show in a 7-day window, which I think is fair enough. But then they described a TV show had to have a minimum of 5 episodes per season, because later on in the top 10 was The Inbetweeners. And you can binge The Inbetweeners, I mean, you can binge the whole thing in a day if you really wanted to, because it's 6 20-odd minute episodes per season. So, you know, not all binges are created equal. But what they are saying is that 90% of subscribers do at least one binge in their first year.
That's it, because it also, but it, to me, it also says that that means that the people who are doing all this binging are of a certain age, certain demographic, don't have kids.
Probably.
Nobody can binge that amount in a week if you've children. It's just, you know, unless, you know, you're going to have social services down on top of you. Right, we have to take a commercial break. Two more shows to talk about.
The Curragh, County Kildare, a shop servicing the army camp, has sold a €500,000 jackpot ticket. And everyone's been burning to know the identity of the lucky winner.
At 7 o'clock in the morning when we opened up, our cashier was asking every single person at the till, was it you? Was it you? And one person went quiet and she asked them, and that was Jimmy. So we knew then that Jimmy had won.
Right. I saw a trailer for this and I thought it was a fascinating idea. In that the trailer at least gave the impression that it was about you're suddenly rich, but perhaps that can be a mixed blessing to some degree or another. Is that actually what it's about? Because that sounds more like...
So I was more suckered a bunch. I was suckered into thinking it was going to be more about kind of how fun it is to win the lotto, right? Mm. And it started off with this. It started off with this kind of fun behind the scenes look. This is, sorry, we should say we won the lotto, which is on RTE1. And there's a second part of it next week as well. Mm. And it started off with this behind the scenes look at Lotto HQ, which I think is on one of the Abbey streets.
Yeah.
And they were saying, like, you know, only the winners get to see behind this magic door. And this door actually had a window in it. And I thought, okay. And they led you into this room where if you have won the lotto, you get treated to a video with Craig Doyle saying, oh, so you've won the lotto. And it couldn't be like more Celtic Tiger if it tried, right? And I kind of thought, okay, this is kind of cute. It's going to go look at like kind of the history of the lotto and kind of the fun, cute side of the lotto. Now, the problem with it is it then took this massive pivot into this dreary, almost like... It was like watching, you know, like some drama, like a play about how miserable it is to be in Middle Ireland and suddenly come into money and how it all falls apart. Because they featured various winners. The problem is only 10% of winners in Ireland go public.
Yeah.
Because who wants anybody to know that you've come into a fortune? And then presumably of that 10%, the pool that will even speak to you is very limited as well. Mm. So the people we got speaking to us were Billy and Carmel Comer, who I think had won the equivalent of almost 2 million in the early 90s. They had made several bad investments into loads of pubs in Galway, despite the fact that Jim's brothers are two billionaire property investors, which makes it kind of like hard viewing. I have sympathy for the man, but I'm also going, how could your brothers be billionaires and you have been making these bad investments? What is going on? There was no schadenfreude in this viewing because it was just... It was really dreary and sad, and you just couldn't help going, I'd be a better lotto winner than you. Why hasn't it happened to me?
So there you go. There's your schadenfreude there.
Right. Well, that's true. I found it in the end. Then we had Anne Canavan, who had won £1 million on the UK lottery. And she basically was hoarding it. She was going, I'm going to hold on to this for the rest of my life. Spend it needlessly, and she's an inventor and is using the money to finance her inventions in the hope of turning them into kind of gold dust and this sort of JML catalog style thing. Jim and Anne Carroll, we actually saw getting the big check on the day. They had won 500 grand. What was kind of nice about them was you got to see it in real time, and you could see them relishing in their win and sort of being somewhat shell-shocked. Then you just went through all these different winners, what they had done. The most intriguing was this guy named Vincent Keeney, who was living in Cork and in Cove, and had in the 90s won 1 point something million on the lotto and had bought the Dole office and turned it into a Titanic restaurant. And this sort of gave way to this really, I mean, he was a very intriguing kind of very affable kind of West British style guy who had completely fallen, like his life seemed to have fallen apart. He talked about how in the recent years he'd lost a daughter and a brother, and he was used to grief and he wasn't going to dwell on any of this. And he had lived in this kind of beautiful house in Cove that he had then mortgaged against his failing restaurant and lost. And he sort of says, they make him revisit the house and like stand outside the house, and he's going like, you know, if I hadn't won the lotto, I 1000% would still be living in this house. It was my favourite house. I know the neighbours over there. I have such good friends.
Had this house before the lotto.
Yes.
Oh, God.
So it was all...
But I know that's depressing. It's kind of interesting, though.
It is interesting, but it is also quite dreary. And just tonally, I don't know where it's going to go in the second episode because, like...
Now, I must say that music didn't sound like... Anything
get ready,
like
ready for this, yeah, you know, kitchen sink drama that's coming. No, it definitely did not. So it was just, it was oddly paced, I would say. But look, I'm intrigued to kind of see where it's going to go. Maybe they'll go further afield, because But they did throw some very interesting statistics at you, particularly with regard to the US, because in the US, if you want to claim the money, you have to go public. So there's no hiding your identity in the US. And 70% of American lottery winners go bankrupt within 2 decades because suddenly these people who have no experience of being rich suddenly are rich and make really bad investment after bad investment after bad investment. And there's sort of no kind of training in how to be suddenly a $600 millionaire.
Yeah. Right, that's on 9:35 on RT1. You can catch up online, of course, as well. Right, our third show today is Flat Pack Empire. It's on Tuesdays, 9 p.m. BBC Two. Here's a clip.
Jesper may like the idea, but in IKEA, decisions are often made democratically. And Zara still needs to convince the catalogue council that her vision is the best way to sell the company to the world.
I would fight for anything that I think is important. And this council meeting is like a hen house sometimes. It's a total chaos to actually get them to agree on things. You have to be very persuasive.
There you go. That's a Flat Pack Empire. I suppose it's opposite given your man died there.
Yeah, only last week.
Mr. IKEA, whatever his name was.
Mr. Ingvar Kamprad.
Yeah. It also, though, strikes me that a documentary about IKEA probably won't have the dramatic tension than We Won the Lotto has.
Definitely,
perhaps.
Right? So that is actually the fundamental problem with this. This was kind of like as beige as an IKEA couch, right? Now, it is very interesting, don't get me wrong. The BBC was given unfettered access to 12 months behind the scenes in IKEA, including in stores, in the catalogue development, where they print 203 million versions of the catalogue, and the product development side of it, right? And they have created these 3 one-hour shows about IKEA. The problem is they completely and utterly lack any kind of drama. Because they're all so Swedish and nice and just like everything is just like that woman there, she was the head of the catalogue. And what she was trying to do was for the first time ever get people on the front cover of the catalogue. That was her mission. She wanted to humanise IKEA by showing real people using the furniture. And this was considered this completely revelatory thing that if you put people on the front cover instead of just the furniture, what would that mean for IKEA as a brand and so on and so forth. And it's a bit of a kind of like Apple style, really, really intense look at how things are designed and all of the thought processes go behind. Now, she says in that clip there, just listening back to it, oh, this council meeting, it's like a hen house, you know, it's like cutthroat, oh my God. It was the most polite, like, they're like sipping coffee going, but you can't see the cushion. I don't think.
But they're Swedish.
Yeah, they are Swedish.
I mean, they're not
going
to be shouting at each other.
No, but that doesn't make for a good television. You know, it would have been more intriguing to actually see them being vicious and mean to each other. Because do I believe somewhere in the history of IKEA there is a bit of vicious meanness? Yeah. How else would it have become the biggest, you know, furniture thing in the entire world? It was just all very nice and plain and safe. Even arguably the biggest drama in the show sort of hinges on this wild child, I don't know, British designer named Tom Dixon. I'd never heard of him, but seemingly he's like a bit of a well-known...
Oh, he's a mad thing.
Okay, yeah. Right. And he...
No, I just made that. Okay.
So he had been chosen by IKEA to... He is a sort of bespoke furniture designer, and he'd been chosen by them to create something that would appeal to kind of more upwardly mobile shoppers who might think IKEA is a bit beneath them.
Yeah.
And his great idea, first of all, was a crib that would serve as a coffin, which I think he would just come up with entirely for the purpose of being annoying. And then his other great idea was, instead of a sofa bed, a bed sofa. So he created this sort of modular, I mean, let's just call it a flat piece of rectangular cushion on stilts to which you could graft on a few armrests or a light fitting or a side table, or take them all off and put on a single duvet cover and turn it into a twin bed, and that's it. And this is like, you know, this, they go on and on about the design process, and I like fancy design as much as the next millennial, right? I like shiny things, but there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this, and the big drama on that hinged on whether or not they could really market it as a bed, because if they wanted to market it as a bed, they'd have to do more safety tests. So it's all like, will we do the safety test? I don't know. Will we do it? I go on. Like, it was just
And they did.
Yeah.
And do they give a name like Oofenstuffen or one of those weird names?
then the most, I think the most galling thing of the whole thing was they went through that whole process and then they go, well, it'll be individually priced in each country, but it costs the RRP is £700. I'm thinking £700 for a single bed in IKEA? Are you dreaming, right? That was all that I took from the entire show. Beyond the fact that IKEA as a brand and as a company seems really nice and benign and pleasant and fine.
Yeah, so absolutely no surprises there.
Yeah, really, yeah. As good as the meatballs is what I'd say.
Yeah. James Dempsey, thanks very much for coming into us. We'll take a break, back in a couple of minutes after this.